This is Karen from the Maine Humanities Council. I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine.
Welcome back from what I hope was a very pleasant lunch. The title of what I'm going to be dealing with this afternoon that I've given is How to Lose Your Head When All About Are Keeping Theirs, et cetera, et cetera. And it occurred to me after I wrote that down that if you wanted to define romanticism in three words, it would be losing your head. And the converse of that, perhaps enlightenment, would be finding your head or keeping your head or exploring your head, whatever. So I want to deal with some of the general issues that the whole phenomenon of romanticism raises and then apply them very specifically to the story that we've read. The subtitle about the romantic agony is a homage to a book by an Italian critic that was translated to English. The critic was Mario Praz. The English title is The Romantic Agony. It's his study of the darker side of romanticism, its sadomasochism, its necrophilia, its vampirism, its Medusaism, its femme fatalerie, or whatever word, sort of the Adams family legacy of the whole Charles Adams, not John, legacy of romanticism in that kind of over-the-top style. I have to admit that romanticism is very hard to define. But as Mr. Justice Brennan said of pornography, we know it when we see it, or when we hear it. We just heard the national anthem of French romanticism, Hector Berlioz's 1830 Symphonie Fantastique, which is a piece of program music describing his very unhappy love affair with an Anglo-Irish actress. And the March to the Scaffold was a part that was just playing, and it ends with a guillotine, which I thought was quite appropriate for our business this afternoon. The old line about Berlioz was that in the history of music, there had been any number of composers who had enormous amounts of talent, but not very much genius. Berlioz, on the other hand, had tons of genius, but not much talent. And I'm not sure that's a fair assessment. If you love the Troyens, for example, then you know that's not true. But I think that old story does suggest some typical characteristics of romanticism. It's unresolved, tentative, slightly shaggy qualities. It's making a virtue out of a lack of polish and finish, very much different from the 18th century aesthetic. It's refusal to keep within boundaries, its feeling of slippage, and again, its aura of losing your head. We not only know romanticism when we hear it, as in the music of Berlioz, but when we see it, again, I've returned to Delacroix's iconic Liberty Leading the People of 1830, an image that should be very familiar to you by now. I would point out that Stendhal, of course, was in Paris during the events of the July Revolution. He had the street smarts, though, to stay at home. He was actually working on the manuscript of The Red and the Black. So he did not end up like these poor unfortunates at the bottom of the picture. But this is, Liberty literally over the top of the barricades in this case. And I want to show you a different romantic image, which is over the top in a very different sense of the word. This is Girardot's Ossian Receiving the Ghost of the Fallen French Heroes, a painting from 1805, also in the Louvre, as is the Delacroix you just saw. It is a wonderfully batty work, and I chose it not only because it's historically appropriate for what we're talking about, but because it shows the cross-cultural tendencies that are very much part of Romanticism, and that's one of my big themes this afternoon. An ancient Celtic bard, Ossian, the bearded guy in the center, is welcoming the dead Frenchmen and their Corsican emperor. This is the young Napoleon, again, rather feminized looking, as Mary was commenting earlier today, of these earlier images of Napoleon. He's welcoming them into this kind of Hiberno-Germanic warrior heaven, a kind of Valhalla of the French military imagination, with all sorts of people, all sorts of females walking at the bottom, and the heroes lined up in the heroes of the past, the medieval past, and on back, and of course the Napoleonic eagle soaring through the heavens. Now, what adds some poignancy to this scene, other than its awfulness, is the fact that, of course, Ossian was a fake. He was one of the great literary frauds of the late 18th century. A Scotsman named Macpherson had claimed that he had discovered the epic poetry of a 3rd century AD Scots-Gaelic bard, and he published them, and it was a publishing sensation. It was like the Harry Potter of its day. Everyone read it. Napoleon loved it. Thomas Jefferson loved it. Everyone fell for it. And it was the beginnings, you know, it's still the 18th century, that's the beginnings of Romanticism and its medievalism, its love of the past, its search, its historicizing search for a past that's now long gone. But of course, it was Samuel Johnson, among others, led the pack in proving that it was a total forgery. And after a few years, Ossian more or less disappeared, other than from the records of literary history and a few images like this. But it's a wonderful symbol, I think, the time. What I want to do in trying to pull all this together this afternoon is to talk about really four phenomena. One is the nature and the reception of Romanticism in France in the 1820s and 30s, and especially the key role in this cultural transfusion that was played by an extraordinary woman, Germaine de Staël. And I'll be saying more about her a little bit later. I want to talk about Stendhal's problematic position of being a writer who's living at the height of Romanticism and knowing all the, you know, the characters of the Romantic movement, but not really buying into it. In some important ways, he is very much a man of the 18th century who has somehow survived into the literary world of the early 19th. The paradox is, and I would argue, is that in creating Julian Sorel, he produces a quintessentially Romantic protagonist, and I have I hope you got, as you came in, a passage from the novel that, if we have time, we'll look at a little more closely, that I think demonstrates this. And then finally, I want to end with at least a passing note of an American writer, one who has some local connections, who I think has some interesting connections and affinities with Stendhal. And don't worry, it's not Longfellow. My interest in the history of Romanticism, particularly the history of how it travels across national and linguistic boundaries, is really at the heart of what I'm doing here. Romanticism was like a virus. It crosses from one country to another. It mutates. It crosses back. It bounces back. And it spreads in very interesting and in some ways dangerous ways, but in a very pervasive sense. So we see that its beginnings and all those kinds of things in the 18th century, and then it reaches its pinnacle in the 20s and 30s, and then continues to influence the rest of the 19th century in terms of music, literature, painting, et cetera, and historicizing architecture. I'm always struck by the fact that it's really in its heart, I think it's a German phenomenon. But even that is somewhat complicated. The Germans in the late 18th century discover Shakespeare in a big way in the great Schlegel translations that follow. In turn, the German writers and philosophers and thinkers have an enormous impact on the British Romantics, like Wordsworth and Coleridge. And they themselves, working through the conduit of Thomas Carlyle about a decade later, they spread the message of German transcendentalism and German Romanticism here to New England, and to some extent we all are still living in the shadow of that phenomenon. We're all students of Emerson and Thoreau and Margaret Fuller. And it's this cross-cultural phenomenon that I find so fascinating and that I'll mention a little bit about today. I would mention also Rousseau, a Swiss, although he lives most of his life in France. He leaves an indelible mark on every American and European writer of the Romantic period, as in a very different way does the Scot, Sir Walter, who was enormously, even more famous than Ossian. In France, in Stendhal's day, you could buy the collected works of Sir Walter Scott translated into French in 60 volumes, and they sold very, very well. And we don't think much about Scott today, perhaps Sir Walter Scott today, but almost every 19th century literary figure is somehow touched by his influence. And the center of his influence is his ability to take great historical events and to personalize them. to tell some individual story, a very moving and emotional story, but set it against these huge events. And you can imagine how many writers take off with that and run. So even by the 1820s, the Russians were talking about the Romantiki. This is a movement, a way of thinking that spreads very, very far and very quickly. In the little list of quotes that I put in your packet that you should have received yesterday, I've chosen some snippets from a variety of authors that have some relevance to my topic. I'm going to refer to a few of them. If you haven't read them already, perhaps at your own leisure, you might want to look at them. They function sort of as a footnote to what I'm doing, and also as a commentary on it, or perhaps even a contradiction of it, if you want to read them that way. But I was very struck in the first one, the comment by Charles Taylor, who's a modern Canadian philosopher, in his book about the making of modern identity. I'm struck by his comment that we still rely on the vocabularies of Enlightenment and Romanticism. You know, we think we live in a modernist era, but we are still emotionally and intellectually and culturally very much the children of both Enlightenment and Romanticism, and the vocabulary that developed in those periods is one that we still very much deal with. Enlightenment and Romanticism are contradictory, but at the same time, they're rival ways of thinking about the same question. So they have that in common, and that question is simply, who are we and what are we doing here? And they overlap. It's, as I say, Romanticism is a blurring of boundaries. The boundary between those two movements is itself blurred. There was not some moment around 1800 where everyone stopped powdering their hair and became Romantics and moderns. Although after the French Revolution, very few people dared to powder their hair. But it didn't happen that quickly. It's a generational thing, but certainly by Stendhal's day, the great change has taken place. By chance, when I was putting this talk together the other day, I found on the op-ed page of the New York Times the column that's my second quote here, a column entitled The New Humanism by David Brooks. David Brooks, the Edmund Burke of Park Avenue, makes a distinction between the French and British Enlightenment that is, to put it mildly, stunningly wrong. He says that the French Enlightenment is based on individualism and reason, the British Enlightenment on social sentiments. He ignores the French notion of sensibilité, of feeling, of deep feeling, the notion of the honnête homme, the earnest, honest gentleman, and the still controversial legacy of Rousseau that I referred to a moment ago. And on the English side, he ignores the radical skepticism of Priestley and Hume and the cool, unsentimental thought of the utilitarian school. I think Brooks's Tory bias is showing in this column, but I do give him credit. He was trying to squeeze a lot into one long column on the side of the page, and I think he proves Taylor's point that we are still living in a world mentally shaped by such debates between the enlightened and the romantic. So perhaps what Brooks calls a new humanism might be a new romanticism in disguise. Moving on to Stendhal's novel, what I want to start with, though, is one of the oddest moments, I think, in a book that is really full of oddities, as you well know. It's that passage at the very end, the last few paragraphs, where Stendhal wraps up his story rather quickly. I realize some of you haven't quite finished the book, and I apologize for spoiling the ending, but I think by this point you have figured it all out. It's the moment, of course, when Mathilde goes in and visits the corpse of her former lover. I think she's the most interesting character in the story, and here we see one of several reasons why. Mathilde waltzes in and picks up her lover's head. A lesser romantic writer might have had her kiss it and then carefully rewrap it in his blue coat and all that, but not our Mathilde. She carries it off the way you or I might go to the farmer's market on a Saturday and pick out a pumpkin and carry it off under our arm. We next see Julianne's tête on her knees in her veil carriage. Neither Judith nor Salome, our heroine brings head and body back together again in a remote cave high up in Julianne's beloved mountains. To the astonishment of the gaping peasantry, who, as we know, will talk about this strange event for at least a century to come. Now, you or I might have hired the local curé and told him to bring along an acolyte or two, but not Mathilde. In a wonderfully Stendhalian moment, she commissions not one, but 20 priests to perform the rites of interment in a cave filled with, as our narrator tells us, innumerable candles. So try to imagine the choreography of this scene, all those vestments, all that incense, all those clergy, perhaps some of them, Julianne's one-time fellow seminarians, everyone trying not to step on each other's robes in this crowded little cave. Let's push our romantic imaginations a little farther. Stendhal didn't write much in the way of codas to his novels. On the contrary, he was notorious for ending them abruptly, as he does in Charterhouse of Parma, certainly. He doesn't do anything like what George Eliot does at the end of Middlemarch, where she satisfies our readerly curiosity about what happens to everyone in the town, you know, 20 years on, 30 years on, whatever. We don't get any of that from Stendhal. But what we do know is, or what we can read in between the lines, perhaps, is that Mathilde is the funeral itself is not the end, that she goes on and embellishes the tomb, the rustic tomb, in the latest Italian fashion, with very expensive marble statuary. And we know that the peasants in the true Franche-Comtois spirit, as Stendhal would certainly tell us, or would want to tell us, will, in the fullness of time, figure out some way to make money from all the curiosity seekers drawn to this most curious of monuments in the mountains. As we know, this would be the 1830s by that point, and alpine tourism is just beginning to catch on. And this cave is in the Jura Mountains, which are the mountains that separate the Franche-Comté from Switzerland and are sort of, in a sense, the foothills of the Alps. So who knows if this story did go on, if there were a coda to it. As the mosses grew and the mountain ivies embellished this already romantic site, and the sparrowhawk hovered overhead, as barren women and lovesick youths and the merely bored found their way up to the mountainside, and as those first reports began to circulate, the gamey leg healed, the lover brought home safely from the wars, the rival farmer's fox that suddenly dropped dead, the price of oak shingles steadily rising. Well, you can kind of see where we're going. Saint Julian of the Mountains, patron of the young, the headstrong, and the ambitious. So what would have happened to Mathilde in the meanwhile? I think, I would argue that if we were writing this coda, that we would have her, after a decent interval, be married off to an elderly duke, whom she survives by many, many years, and she is accepted back into society, and she ends her days as a prominent Saloniste in the time of the Second Empire. She meets the young Henry James, she meets the very young Marcel Proust, and she dies towards the end of the century. And her hotel in the Faubourg Saint-Germain is at the end of the century, let's say, rented by Edith Wharton. She loves the boiserie. And in the courtyard of that hotel in the 1920s, Hemingway and Fitzgerald have a fistfight. So we could go on and on with this fantasy if we want a coda to The Red and the Black. But to abandon the fantasy and to return to what Stendhal actually wrote is remarkable enough. Mathilde's theatricality, her self-dramatizing, which to us, as several speakers have suggested, seems deranged and in need of medication, and which to our 18th century ancestors certainly would have seemed bizarre behavior. But she presents herself, at least in Stendhalian terms, as a true child of the century. Her strong sense of historicism is very firmly rooted, well-grounded. She evokes her role model, Marguerite de Valois, or also known as Marguerite de Navarre, the 16th century party girl known to her friends as Margot, whose ill-fated lover, Boniface de la Mole, who was an actual historical person, not just a fictional ancestor of a fictional character in this novel, he is Mathilde's reputed ancestor. When Boniface is executed for treason, he's actually hanged, drawn, and quartered, Margot is rumored to have hidden herself near the scaffold and to bribe the executioner for her lover's head. If you know about drawing and quartering, she would have had a selection of body parts, but she supposedly took the head and saved it in a jeweled casket. Alexandre Dumas used this as a basis for a historical thriller in the mid-19th century. And in 1994, the French filmmaker and opera director, Patrice Chéreau, released a film called La Reine Margot, Queen Margot in its English version, which is a very operatic account of this episode from the 16th century wars of religion in France. I was very tempted to show you a clip from this movie. It has the most attractive Isabelle Adjani as Margot, the equally attractive Vincent Perez as Boniface. But the film really, have any of you seen it? You know what I'm talking about. The film is very violent, much too violent, too gory, too raunchy to watch so soon after we just had lunch. So go to Netflix, they certainly have it, and if you're interested in this, all I can say is Alexandre Dumas would have been quite astonished by what they did with his story. But this, in addition to this this real, or probably somewhat true incident from earlier French history, there are many other precedents for what Mathilde does with Julien's head. A lifelong Italophile, Stendhal certainly knew his Boccaccio. In the Decameron, we find the story, for example, of Isabel in the pot of basil. Her brothers kill her lover. They are upset that she's taken a lover, but she saves his head after he has been finished off, and she puts it in a pot and plants a basil on top of it. You may never want to eat pesto again, but this was a very famous story that appears in the Decameron and elsewhere. And certainly for anyone to whom the revolution, this is a pre-Raphaelite image of it by the British painter William Holman Hunt. For certainly anyone for whom the revolution was a fresh memory, the notion of dismemberment would have been a sharp and quite vivid memory. Although we have to remember at the time, the guillotine, when it was first instituted during the revolution, was regarded, and I think quite rightly, as a very humane device compared to earlier methods of drawing and quartering, et cetera. And it lasted in France. I'm not quite sure who the last person to be guillotined was. You could probably find this in Wikipedia. But it was certainly, at least as late as World War II, it was still being used. I am told that all you feel is a slight tickle on the back of your neck, and then it's over. But given the Christian penchant for colorful martyrdoms, the iconography of European art had been filled since the Middle Ages with detached body parts. Whenever you go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, for example, if you walk through the rooms that have the Italian Mannerist and Baroque paintings, they are so gruesome. It's the most horrible tortures and executions and flagellations and blood and gore everywhere. And then you step out of those rooms into the Dutch rooms, and they're full of fruit and flowers and pearls and well-scrubbed interiors. And it's really, it's almost a religious moment of relief as you move from one sensibility to the other. But certainly in the Middle Ages and long after, these artistic depictions of martyrdom, particularly of decapitations, were very powerful and certainly are part of our cultural heritage in reading a story like this. And I would just mention that Saint Denis, for example, whom you see here, the patron saint of Paris and the namesake of the Abbey Church where Gothic architecture is invented, he is one of these people who does literally lose his head. And I've always wondered, what did he do with it afterwards? He wanders off. You see the medieval sculptures where he's carrying it under his arm. He walks off into the book of the Golden Legend, into the lives of the saints, those seminal texts for all of us who do biography. And I would ask you to remember also that dismemberment can even be followed by dismemberment, as we saw in the story of Dr. Frankenstein a few years ago and his unhappy creature who is assembled from body parts. So as one who still manages to be perplexed by Stendhal, delightedly so, I'm happy to be perplexed by him, I have to ask you if the ending of this novel is not an elaborate joke on his part. We take it seriously when we read it, at least the first few times, but how seriously did he take it? And I don't have the answer to that. But I think living in the age of romanticism, perhaps he said to himself, I'll have to finish this off as a romantic novel, and I'll give them Mathilde as well as Julien, and what kind of story can I concoct to carry this out? So, there's certainly no mistake that in a geographical sense and in a biographical sense, Stendhal was living at the very heart of French romanticism and would have been subject to this sort of influence, this sort of temptation, even though, of course, he spends long periods of his life in his beloved Italy, and he goes on his ill-timed trip to Russia with Napoleon's army. But as early as 1823, and well ahead of the romantic crowd, he wrote a pamphlet that later appeared as a book called Racine and Shakespeare, and it rapidly became a manifesto of this new romanticism. It attacked the traditional French system of classical theater, which had been enshrined, or Stendhal would have said, embalmed at the state-run Comédie Française. It was a rigid system of rules, supposedly inherited from Aristotle and his poetics, but in fact a legacy of the cultural control set up by Louis XIV as part of his absolutist system. And it's a long list of rules. It has to do with the theatrical unities. The entire play must take place in continuous time, what we'd call real time. Nothing violent can happen on stage. There has to be a certain decorum in the language, that sort of thing, which in the hands of the great tragedians, of the tragic playwrights of the 17th century, could produce psychologically powerful work, as we see in Corneille and Racine. But by 1823, it was all pretty ossified. And it had this very heavy political connotation to it, too. To be traditional and orthodox in a theater, obviously, as some of the speakers have mentioned, meant to be orthodox and conservative in your politics. So Stendhal, in this pamphlet, says, he doesn't define romanticism, I think we would define romanticism, but he defines it as everything that's new. It's kind of an anticipation of Ezra Pound saying, make it new. But he's saying this in 1823. It's everything that's new, that's innovative, that's transgressive, that's rule-breaking. Romanticism is the movement of youth. Classicism is the dead hand of the fathers. And he was there. The play, Hugo's play, Hernani, has been mentioned earlier, but I just would point out that both Stendhal and Delacroix were there on the night in 1830 when the famous premiere took place led to a great scandal. It's one of these, French love these theatrical scandals. Think of the first night of Tannhäuser at the Paris Opera in 1860, or the first night of Rite of Spring in 1913. So they love these over-the-top dramas that involve not what's happening on stage so much as what's happening in the audience. And the play, as you know, survives in a Verdi opera, as Teresa pointed out. And the Met, by the way, is doing this opera next season, so if you're in New York or if you're watching the opera in HD, there might be a chance to catch up on Hernani. In this same atmosphere of cultural change, this very heady atmosphere, Stendhal was among the writers and talkers of the time, and he was as much of a talker as a writer in these days. Probably better known in Paris for his talk in various salons and cafes and what have you. He was known as one of the greatest enthusiasts for the new world of romantic ballet, another aspect of this great shift to a romantic sensibility. Jennifer Homans has written a wonderful history of ballet that came out last year called Apollo's Angels, and she speaks of the sensation of the dance world in Paris in the early 1830s associated with the dancer Marie Taglioni, and particular her role as the lead in a ballet, in a new ballet called La Sylphide. Now, ballet had originated as a court dance in the time of Louis XIV. In fact, the king himself actually danced in many of these early productions. He always played the role of Apollo. He was the sun king, so who was going to tell him not to? But by the time of the post-revolutionary time in Paris, that kind of court ballet was obviously long out of fashion and politically incorrect in a lot of ways. And so under the influence of a lot of Italian dancers and dance impresarios, a new style of ballet emerges that Homans describes beautifully in this book, which I recommend very highly to you. Dance becomes feminized, it becomes romanticized and eroticized in a lot of ways. The ballet La Sylphide is a case in point. It's an improbable tale of a Scottish villager haunted by a spirit on the eve of his marriage, and she's a very seductive sylph, and she literally destroys him. The ballet itself is a far more physical style, it represents a far more physical style of dancing than what had preceded it in the 18th century. And it has this quality that combines the erotic and the spiritual in a way that strikes us, I think, as very odd, but in the early 19th century was the hottest thing. ballets like this thrill the romantics. Today, if you go to the ballet and see La Sylphide, it's kind of a museum piece, and you know it's technically perfect, but it's lost the kind of raw quality that it would have had to these early audiences. So this is one more aspect of Stendhal's immersion in romanticism. Yet there's a side, a non-romantic side of him that I think is far more predominant. And I think it helps explain the strange moments in his two big novels, his two great novels, the strange moments of peace and self-fulfillment when his young male heroes, if we can use that word, both experience in prison a sense of withdrawal from the world, a deep detachment, a kind of fulfillment. Their lives are over in a way, but they have reached some state where they have feel alive for the first time. I think this is perhaps a residue of Stendhal's own personal biography, his shattered Napoleonic dream. In the best of all worlds for him, in his idealized world, he would have ended up as a high Napoleonic official, you know, ruling some small country or whatever. That didn't happen. His administrative skills were of no use after the fall of the empire. Yet he's still, you know, he's such a paradox in so many ways and such a self-contradictory figure. He is trying to be this romantic outsider, and he fashions himself in a kind of Byronic way, or so he would think. But at the same time, he's always still looking for the office, the high office, the government post. And he ends up, of course, as a consular official at a fairly respectable and high level, but as one of the previous speakers announced, in an Italian port city that was extraordinarily dull, and where he was very unhappy, and from which he tried to escape as often as possible. So this Napoleonic dream is shattered. His life goes in directions he never anticipated, and I think this vision of both Julian and of Fabrice in the Charterhouse of Parma in prison is something somehow part of Stendhal's attempt to kind of cure his own melancholy. But the other great quality, and it's far more of an 18th century quality than an early 19th century one, is the mordant irony that pervades just about every line he writes. I have two favorite examples of it I want to give you. The first is, the children adored him. This is when he's tutoring the Renal children. The children adored him. He did not care for them. His mind was elsewhere. The casual cruelty of this observation, its laser-like ability to reach to the core of Julian's character, its rather offhand tone, above all its implicit rejection of the sentimentalizing of childhood, which was so strong a trait of romanticism. Well, you see what I mean. My other example is a little less obvious, perhaps, but I think it sustains my point. In the chapter describing Julian's life as a young seminarian at Besançon, the narrator remarks, at the seminary, there is a method of eating a hen's egg that displays the amount of progress made in the devout life. Now, I invite you to go home and try this. Try a boiled egg, or several boiled eggs, and practice on it. How do you eat an egg in a way that expresses a growing sense of religiosity? You know, it's a wonderfully ironic, it's a small moment in the story, but it has that ironic tone, that mordancy that I think is one of Stendhal's most interesting and attractive features. It's part of his visceral contempt, obviously, for the corruptions and hypocrisies of the church. Yet its tone is so 18th century in its slyness and its dry wit. So my point here is that Stendhal is living in a romantic age and participating in it, contributing to it in many, many ways, at the same time still has maybe more than one foot back in the 18th century and feels more comfortable there. And so part of the tension and the perplexity in his writing perhaps comes out of trying to resolve these two conflicting impulses. I want to point out something else too, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to do this, but I would like to argue that The Red and the Black is the first gay novel. It's the first, I would say, the first substantial gay novel in the mainstream tradition of the European novel. There is some degree of gay activity hinted at in Balzac's Human Comedy, but it's really not till we get to André Gide and Proust and Colette and Marguerite Yourcenar in the 20th century that an openly gay novel emerges from the French literary closet. But is The Red and the Black not the story of a young man who has to hide his true identity in order to pass, in order to survive in the world, in order to accomplish what he wants to accomplish? And it's not the one moment when Julian, who's normally cool as a concombre, when he almost succumbs to panic. It's the moment when he fears that his picture of Napoleon, that he has hidden in the mattress, is about to be discovered, and you know, his cover blown. He's about to be outed, as we might say, and his legitimist pretenses exposed as fraud, as fraudulent. It's very like the moment, perhaps, in any gay teenager's life when the teenager's parents discover the copy of Out magazine tucked under the bed, or whatever its hetero equivalent might be in other biographies. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that Julian is really gay in the 21st century sense of that term. I mean, there's no evidence of that whatsoever. But, you know, I'm leaving aside the question for the moment to what extent a fictional character could be really anything, but we won't go there. I want to linger on this suggestion, at least for a moment, because a number of critics have looked at the homoerotic side of Julian's story, and I think both my fanciful suggestion and this evidence of the homoeroticism helps us explain why Stendhal in many ways comes across as a strikingly modern writer, not only as someone torn between the Enlightenment and Romanticism, but someone who is still alive in many ways in our own time. Certainly, much of Julian's success in the world must be due to the fact that he is physically beautiful. Would a homelier Julian have gotten very far? His history of patronage, first with the two abbés, then the worldly marquis, then the cynical bishops, surely it had some deeper origin, some deeper attraction than the fact he had memorized all that Latin. Even Norbert, the marquis's pleasant but lackluster son, succumbs to Julian's charm and treats him like a brother, as improbable as that seems. You can read, and as you can read in Jonathan Keats' excellent biography of Stendhal, Stendhal himself was candid enough to admit that while he was attracted to women almost 100% of the time, there was the occasional slippage when he felt some twinge of desire for someone of his own sex, especially in 1815 when Paris was filled with all these beautifully uniformed Allied officers after the fall of Napoleon. So I throw that out just as a reminder of the modernity of this writer and what I would argue is part of his appeal. We remember too that in the courtroom where Julian is tried and condemned, the galleries are filled with the local ladies who have come there not only because of the pathos of his case and the notoriety of the case, but because of the aura he himself conveys even in this moment of his deepest humiliation. And in the postmortem scene of the novel, it is the ever faithful Fouquet, to whom Julian does indeed seem the chief man in his life, who is prostrate with grief, not the ever resourceful Mathilde. If Julian only listened to Fouquet and gone into the lumber business, think how much happier they all might have been, and he would have ended up as mayor of Verrières or whatever. So at this point, we should probably ask, what does Julian really look like? Despite his love for military costumery and despite his instinctive understandings of the cut of a fashionable coat once he gets to Paris, Julian is not a conventional masculine beauty. As Mary pointed out, there's a fragility to him, a frailness, something heart-stoppingly vulnerable about him, and this is certainly much of his appeal. He's more like Ben Whishaw in the Keats movie, Bright Star, perhaps, the Jane Campion movie about Keats, than, say, Gerard Philippe in the older French movie version of Red and the Black, or the young Alain Delon, the leopard. Perhaps Julien looks like this. This is another iconic image of Romanticism, a painting called The Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog, produced in 1818 by the German artist Caspar David Friedrich. Friedrich is not very well known in this country. I'm not sure that any of his work is in any American museum. I'm not up to date on that, but you really have to go to Germany to see him. He was rediscovered in a big way in the 1960s and 70s, and he's now regarded as the greatest German painter of the 19th century, and one whose landscapes in particular come closest to putting on canvas the real inner world of German romantic sensibility, a sensibility that would have so much influence on the French as well as the English and the Americans. Stendhal does not allow Julian to get quite so lost in the clouds as this, but this image, which in this case depicts the forest and mountains of Saxony, does suggest a link to the forest and mountains of the Vosges, of Franche-Comté, which you find in chapter 10 of the books. The Northern Romantics were really fascinated by mountains and caves, as we've touched on before. Stendhal himself has an obsession with towers and prisons. But it's rather rare, certainly in The Red and the Black, for Stendhal to do much descriptive writing. He doesn't waste his time, doesn't waste a lot of words on scenery. But there is one moment, and that's what the handout is, the yellow page, where I think he does come very close to entering the mood, the innerlichkeit, to perhaps use the German word, that the Frasier's painting suggests. We're not quite sure whether this moment of reverie that Julian has in the mountains is a kind of lyric that he's singing to himself, to his own ego, or whether he's actually losing himself in the beauty of the landscape. Let me, I produced a kind of condensed version of this. Let me read through it very quickly. And then I gave you the French version of it here too that you might want to work your way through on your own. But I want to point out a few things in both. The English version first. Julian quickly escaped and climbed up in the great woods through which one can go from Vergy to Verrières. He was almost sensitive for a moment to the enchanting beauty of the woods through which he strode. Long ago, vast fragments of bare rock had fallen from the mountainside in the midst of the forest. Great beech trees had grown up nearly as high as these rocks, the shade of which produced a delicious freshness. Julian paused for a breath for a moment in the shadow of the great rocks, then resumed his climb. Soon, by a scarcely distinguishable path used only by goat herds, he found himself standing on top of a huge rock and satisfied that he was quite isolated from humankind. This physical situation made him smile, for it represented to him the moral situation he burned to attain. The pure air of the high mountains spoke to his soul of serenity, even joy. Standing upright on his great rock, Julian contemplated the sky glowing with the August sun. Cicadas were chirping in the countryside below the rock, and when they ceased, all around him was silence. He could see 20 leagues of country spread out before his feet. From time to time, a sparrow hawk from the huge rocks above his head made itself visible, describing its vast circles in silence. Julian's eye automatically followed the bird of prey. Its calm and powerful flight impressed him. He envied that strength, he envied that isolation. It was the destiny of Napoleon. Would it one day be his? Now, in working through this, I think we do recapture something of this German romantic moment. And the question is, why is a French writer indulging in something that seems somewhat Germanic? And I want to move on to that point. But before I do, I just would like to say a little bit about the translation that we've been using. I chose this book because I thought it had very good notes and a very good introduction. There are other translations in English of The Red and the Black. There's one by Burton Raphael that's still in print, and in some ways it's much looser and more modern sounding than this English translation, English in the British sense. And I noticed, my French, what I've discovered in putting up this talk is that my French is almost as bad as Stendhal's English. You may know the story that whenever Stendhal wanted to make sure the secret police weren't reading his letters, he would write passages in English. And he usually got the words right, but the idioms were kind of twisted and turned upside down. And I take some consolation that my French is as bad as his English. But a few things jump out at me that where the English just doesn't convey what the French has. And the second line of the French, where talking about à la beauté ravissante, enchanting in English is not the same thing as ravissant in French. And I could go through this whole passage, and I would invite the real French scholars here to do so, to help me out if the situation arises when we have our panel discussion. But what I'm trying to remind us, I think, right here, as a little bit of a digression, is that there is a book in French published in 1830 by a writer who calls himself Stendhal, and there's a book in English published in 2002 by an academic named Roger Gard. The two closely resemble one another, but they're not the same book. So please keep this in mind when you're reading the English. And I'm sure many of you have a much better command of French than I do, and I would urge you to look at some of the original text to see the sort of subtle changes and the not so subtle losses that take place. And I know Mary Ellen referred to this also in terms of the very ending of the story. And I would recommend in this regard a recent book by Edith Grossman. She's the woman who translated the Don Quixote that we read a few years ago. She has a small book called Why We Need Translation, and she warns us of these kind of hazards. Don't assume that you're reading the same book as the original in the translation. At any rate, it's just something to keep in mind. But I want to go back to my question of why a French romantic, even a dubious French romantic, perhaps, as we might want to think of Stendhal, why would he be conveying this kind of landscape worship that we see in this passage that I just read? And I think the crucial figure here is a woman I'm going to take a few minutes to talk about. And I wish I had all afternoon. She's one of the most fascinating women of the 19th century. Germaine de Staël, sorry. She's usually referred to as Madame de Staël. She is, in the words of several commentators, the first modern woman, the first European woman, the last of the great holders of political and literary salons that really had some power. She's one of the inventors of sociology. She invents comparative literature, and she's a pioneer cultural anthropologist. And she's also, in terms of her time, a major novelist and essayist. She, in a way, is a combination of, say, if you took Mary McCarthy, Susan Sontag, Simone de Beauvoir, and threw in Pamela Harriman, you would have Germaine de Staël. She was someone who was just bigger than life. And she drew all kinds of criticism, of course. She was so independent, so strong a woman, so outspoken a woman, that she obviously created a whole coterie of enemies as well as followers. She had had affairs with a vast number of important and interesting men of her time, and she was at the center of almost every literary and cultural and artistic phenomenon of her day. Her father had been the Swiss banker who had tried to save the French monarchy at the very end, Jacques Necker, who comes in and tries to recoup Louis XVI's disastrous finances. And he almost succeeds, but fails. And he even lends the French government a lot of money that his daughter later tries very hard to recover and eventually does, but it takes years and years. But she had grown up in Paris. Her mother conducted a very famous salon. And she was one of these incredibly erudite and a brilliant conversationalist, an exhausting conversationalist. People who spent the weekend at her chateau would often, you know, just be drained by the end of the party. There had been such an intensity of activity, both during day and night, but particularly the conversation had been so intense. And everyone in Europe of any cultural importance went to see her. She was like a great landmark. Napoleon, of course, hated her. Napoleon couldn't stand independent women. Napoleon's idea of a true woman was Josephine with her roses at Malmaison, or someone who had no opinions and who would listen to him. The style was always full of opinions, and Napoleon wasn't such a monster that he had her imprisoned, but he did the next worst thing from the point of view of a Parisian. He had her exiled. She couldn't come within 40 miles of Paris or something like that, and that was a kind of social death to someone in those days. But of course, she survives Napoleon and flourishes in the Restoration, and although, again, she's still very much a critic, very much a progressive figure. She writes two books that I want to mention very briefly in passing here. And the first is a novel not read very much today, other than perhaps among specialists. But in its own day, it was a sensation. It's called Corinne, C-O-R-I-N-N-E. It's the story of an extremely self-willed and independent woman who has a career as a sort of performer in early 19th century Italy, and particularly in Rome. And it's a work that inspired a number of other writers and inspired a number of other women to lead independent lives of their own. It's hard to imagine Margaret Fuller, for example, particularly when she goes off to fight in the Roman Revolution. It's hard to imagine her without the example of de Staël's Corinne. And even in George Eliot's Mill on the Floss, one of the characters, is Maggie Tulliver, is reading Corinne. So this book appears again and again, and I have some quotes in my handout that I gave you, the excerpts that attest to that, to its power. But the book that really is the crucial link between the kind of romantic image I just had on the screen, and the story at hand is her book called D'Allemagne, Germany, which comes out in 1813. Napoleon has it banned. He has all the copies burned, but she smuggles a copy out, and she made an extra copy of the manuscript. And it's published in England and very quickly translated and published all over the world. And it's the book that, in a nutshell, explains Germany to the French. The French had not had much curiosity about other cultures in the 18th and early 19th century. But all of a sudden, they kind of hear something strange is going on in Germany. There are all these philosophers and poets and artists and who are doing interesting things. And Madame de Staël is the one who writes the one book that introduces all this to a French audience, and also to an American audience. Emerson is very much influenced, and Emerson's wonderful aunt, Mary Moody Emerson, she's a great fan of this book. So again, it's this romantic cross-fertilization of crossing of cultures and whatever. One of, you know, Germany is a travel book to an extent. It's a cultural guidebook. She explains all sorts of things about German morals and marital practices and architecture and landscape and whatever. But she, perhaps her strongest message in the book is that what the Germans have and what the French don't have is enthusiasm. And she reminds us that the word enthusiasm means, in its original form, the God within us. Germans have this inner spirit that she says the French lack. What the French have instead is a fear of ridicule. That's the worst thing that can happen to you in France, she says, to be ridiculed. The Germans don't care if they're ridiculed. They're enthused. And this is a pretty radical idea in intellectual and cultural circles in 1813 in Paris. Napoleon thinks the book is totally anti-French. And aside from his personal dislike of her, that's one of the reasons why tries to have it destroyed. But it survives and I think is very much part of this world that Stendhal is living in and writing in and thinking through. And I wish I had more time to talk about Madame, but she would be worth a program of her own. I don't know if she taught in colleges and universities now. Good. I would just like to wrap this up by making that suggestion I promised you at the beginning, that there is an American writer who is, let me just go back to Stendhal. Yeah, we'll close with this. This is Stendhal in late middle age. There's an American writer who, like Stendhal, resists being too neatly pigeonholed, although he's obviously a member of the pantheon of American literary culture, a member of the canon of the American literary renaissance. He spends most of his life here in New England, but in parts of New England that were very much connected with German transcendentalism and European romanticism, places like Salem, Boston, Concord, Lenox, even here in Brunswick. He participates briefly in the socialist Brook Farm experiment at Roxbury. He befriends Emerson and Margaret Fuller. He befriends the Peabodys, ends up marrying one of them. He is the poet of the New England past, in a sense, especially its darker, guilt-haunted side. And in stories like The Birthmark and Rappaccini's Daughter, and the minister's black veil, he proves himself the American equivalent of E.T.A. Hoffman as a great master of the romantic short story and novella. In his final and most confused novel, The Marble Faun, which is set in Rome in the 1850s, he definitely conjures up in the character of Miriam, the character of Corinne from the Stiles novel of Rome in the 1820s. So it's all these interesting romantic connections between, obviously, man I'm talking about is Nathaniel Hawthorne. There are these interesting parallels of Hawthorne as a romanticist and Stendhal as a romanticist. Yet like Stendhal, there's some very large part of Hawthorne that doesn't buy into this romantic program. He's not a good fit with the transcendentalist. He is notoriously ambiguous on the question of slavery. He infuriates Emerson and the rest of the Emersonian crowd because of his friendship with the pro-Southern politician Franklin Pierce. And he has a lifelong suspicion of reformers and do-gooders. And although it's not as pronounced as Stendhal, his sense of irony makes him sort of a sore thumb among the very earnest New England reformers of his time, many of whom he seems to have trouble taking seriously. And certainly in his satire of Brook Farm the Blithedale Romance. You know, this comes through very strongly. So this is a passing thought. There are so many differences, cultural as well as psychological, between Hawthorne and Sandal. I don't want to push the suggestion too far, but it does suggest a paradox of the creative life. For all our talk of movements, for all our careful biographical trackings of connections and influences and affinities, perhaps some writers do their best work against the grain of their age. Thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.